Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Let's say you want to go to war and it's 1200 AD in France. You're a knight and you're the dominant force on the battlefield. You probably lead a cavalry charge, and a cavalry charge of knights on their steeds is one of the greatest offensive weapons around. Now, your enemy is probably going to be in a castle, so you have to know all about siege warfare, how to make siege towers, maybe how to dig or tunnel or do whatever you can to overcome these thick walls. By the time you get into the 15th and 16th centuries, warfare changes completely. Cannons make castles obsolete, firearms and pikes replace the sword, knights are no longer the dominant fixture on the battlefield, and also warfare gets a lot bigger. Instead of a few thousand or maybe a few tens of thousands of people in pitched battle, you can get armies with hundreds of thousands of people. To talk about what happens in history, and not just with military technology, but with bureaucracy, with record keeping, and other things that create the modern state, is Patrick Wyman. Patrick is the host of the Tides of History podcast. He looks at how echoes of the past define everything in our society. What we eat and drink, how we spend money, what language we speak, and how we raise our children. So we're going to talk about how this change happens. And Patrick looks at both the large-scale macro-level issues of the invention of gunpowder, the spread of contracts, but he also looks at the micro issue, the story of adventurers and mercenaries that go fight for the Holy Roman Empire in the 1500s and 1600s. And I also asked Patrick, if you were sent back in time in 1300, what would you do to try to make the world early modern? Would you be a metallurgist who invents the pistol? Would you basically be an IRS agent who forces everyone to keep tax receipts and make contracts of everything? And Patrick says that firearms are more fun, but sadly, IRS contracts are the way to go. Plus, he also talks about historical inaccuracies, and he dishes on a movie that's probably every dude bro's favorite film of all time. Really enjoyed this talk with Patrick. He is able to think on both huge and small scales, and it was a lot of fun. Enjoyed this discussion with Patrick Wyman. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on.
We're going to get a lot into the Middle Ages and the early modern period, but I want to talk about something first of all. That me personally, when I watch movies, I can get really annoyed by how many inaccuracies are there for anything that happens in history, as long as you get out of living memory. So something like Mad Men is pretty good because people were around during that time. But something anytime 100 years in the past, and especially in the Middle Ages, gets things really wrong. For you as a medievalist, what are things that annoy you the most, or what is a movie that's annoyed you the most for how wrong it got history?
So the little details, things like an object out of place, something along those lines, that doesn't really bother me all that much. A fact wrong, a date wrong, collapsing timelines for the sake of entertainment value, that doesn't really bother me so much. What bothers me is when it doesn't get the feel right, when there are ideas about how the world is supposed to work that are drastically out of place. So Gladiator, hate it. Absolutely hate it as a movie about the past. I love it as an action movie. I think it's a fantastic action movie. But as a representation of Rome in the second century AD, it basically just transposes late 20th century ideas about freedom and liberty and self-determination back into a time where those things were not at all accepted in anything close to like that form. That bothers me so much more than any sort of inaccuracy about date or the personality of a historical character, anything like that. Because like the past should feel foreign. It should feel alien in really basic ways because people didn't share our basic assumptions about how the world is supposed to work. And when something doesn't capture that, that's what gets me.
Right. It's one thing for something like the Broadway musical Hamilton, where it's not trying to be accurate. Obviously, the founding fathers weren't multiracial. But when something purports to be the true story, the story that you were never told in history class, but then still messes it up, that's where it can really get annoying.
Yeah, that really bothers me.
Well, we could go on this forever because there's so many Hollywood movies that get it wrong. And I think we can both agree that if there's anyone that gets it 100% right, it's 300. They get every single detail right about the past.
Every piece. Perfect. Absolutely perfect.
Yeah, we can both put our stamp on it. Everything in that movie is right. So go watch it. Better than any book you'll read. So something I really like that you've done in your podcast is get into the mechanics of what warfare looked like. Not just this army fought that army and there were this many casualties and this geopolitical result, but what it was like to actually raise up an army, how you allocated funds, how you got food and weapons, and how you managed supply trains and everything going into it. Let's start from this point and look at the Middle Ages. Walk us through. Let's say I'm a king. Maybe I'm the king of France in the 1200s, and I want to wage a war. I want to join a crusade to Egypt or Tunisia or wherever. How would I raise up an army?
Okay, well, crusades are a little different because of the voluntary aspect of taking the cross and the fact that at that point, the people who would be joining the army would generally be paying their own way. So I want to sidebar crusades because they function a little differently. But if you're the king of France and you want to go to war with the king of England, say, generally how that's going to work is you call up your vassals. You're going to put out the call to all of the subordinates who hold land in return for military service, and to their subordinates who hold land from them in return for military service. This is, at the most basic level, the feudal system, is land holding in return for military service. This is where we get knights in shining armor and all of that is from this particular system. Now, there are going to be limits on how long you can keep that army in the field because feudal service is not indefinite service, right? Like there are limits on it. Usually 40 days is a pretty standard term length. So if you're going to fight a war, you're going to have to do it pretty quickly. Well, obviously most wars aren't going to be over in 40 days. So you've got to find some kind of workaround for that. Already by the 13th century, they're looking for workarounds for this. One of the ways that you start to see crop up at that point is just paying wages. In lieu of land holding for military service, you can just say, okay, well, you are my feudal underling. You are supposed to do me service, but we're going to be at this for longer than 40 days, so I will pay you some amount for your time. But at the most basic level, military service is still going to be based on vassalage. If you need to hire foot soldiers to supplement your corps of armored knights, aristocratic knights, then you're generally going to be paying them wages. Either that or they're going to be more or less conscripted peasants. But for the most part, military service, at least the core of your armies, is going to be based on ties of obligation. Like because you are in a personal relationship, social and political and economic relationship with a superior, you owe them military service in return for the land rights that you hold.
Okay, that's the Middle Ages. Now let's jump forward to 1600, and you can choose whatever political unit you want, some part of the Holy Roman Empire, a principality in what is now Germany, and you want to wage war at this period. How would you raise up an army at this time, and how is it different from 1200s?
Okay, well, let's say you're the Holy Roman Emperor in the 16th or the early 17th century, and you want to put together an army. You are going to contract with a military entrepreneur. As this period goes on, the activities of military entrepreneurs get bigger and bigger, like they become more and more important figures. If you're talking about, 1500, 1530, military entrepreneurs are going to be relatively small scale. If you're talking about closer to the 30 Years' War, military entrepreneurs get really, really, really big. Basically, this is privatized warfare based on a system of private contracts and a private market for mercenaries that extended all through Europe. So let's say you're the Holy Roman Emperor and you need to put together an army to go fight, could be the Turks. Let's say you're going to go fight the Ottomans along the frontier in Hungary. So to do that, you contract with one or more of these military entrepreneurs for a particular number of troops. They go out, send their recruiters out, and recruit from the mercenary market. So let's say you need 20,000 troops. You're going to contract with one guy who can bring you 10,000 troops, two guys who can bring you 3,000 troops, and one guy who's going to bring you 4,000 troops. And that gets you up to the 20,000 troops that you need. But basically, it's handled through private channels. You may have something like standing armies or a small corps of standing armies, especially in France, not so much in England. In Spain, the standing army was much larger. But for the most part, what meets the demand for military services is an international market in mercenaries handed by private military contractors who can go and tap into that market.
And the size of these armies get mind-bogglingly large. So Charles V, the Holy Roman Empire that was the sort of the opponent of Suleiman the Magnificent and the Ottoman Empire. I mean, they're just, the size of them are enormous. Is it, how big were standing armies at this point? Let's say mid 16th century.
Okay. Well, it wouldn't have been necessarily a standing army. Like the actual standing professional, fully in service all the time army may have been 10, 15, 20,000 organized in Spain in tercios. But at any given time, there was a point where Charles V had 200,000 troops under arms that he was paying for, that because he was simultaneously carrying on wars in Italy, in France. He had troops garrisoned in the Low Countries. He had troops in Germany, and then he had troops along the frontier with the Ottomans. So it wasn't necessarily a standing army, but you were constantly rotating in new mercenaries into that group. And over time, as you're carrying on this long succession of wars over the 16th century, you start to get a lot more professionals. They may not be in the same army for that whole time, but they were people who made war their profession.
Okay, so let's get into the heart of the matter. And this is a very big question, and this is something you've spent a considerable amount of time talking about and researching. But what are the principal factors that trigger these changes? And this affects, of course, warfare, but then also all sorts of other factors that create what we call the early modern period.
So there are a lot of different pieces to it. I think that you can start with technology, maybe. I think technology is not necessarily a bad place to start, but like, you know, technology is not separable from the culture and social arrangements that make use of it. So let's start at a basic level with technology. The first piece is gunpowder, and especially corned gunpowder and cannon that were capable of knocking down castle walls, more or less. And you start to see this in really starts to take effect, I would say, with Henry V's campaigns after the Battle of Agincourt, because he just kind of rolls through Normandy and northern France with an artillery train, knocks down the walls of a whole bunch of towns and takes them all very, very quickly. Whereas before sieges, if you wanted to take a fortified, well-defended town or a castle, it was going to take you months, years to do that. Instead, with the introduction of cannon, that happens almost overnight. But cannons are expensive. They're expensive to cast. They're expensive to operate. You need like basically experienced professionals to use them properly. They're difficult to supply with gunpowder. All of that costs a ton of money. And in order to make that an effective part of a military force, you're going to need to tax more heavily. You need more funds in order to bring that to bear. And that's what we see over the course of the 15th century is state structures that evolve in order to provide the money necessary to have things like expensive cannon, to have things like the core of standing armies. Even if you're not going to have a full standing army, even if you're just going to have a core of one that you then supplement with mercenaries, having a standing army is incredibly expensive. So you start to see this kind of synergy between state structures and technological change and military change, that war becomes more expensive, and in order to pay for war, you have to develop structures of taxation and bureaucracy to pay for that. So those two things go hand in hand. As castles become no longer viable, you have to build more and better fortifications. So this is where the art and science of fortification in the early modern period becomes a thing. You start to build things like angled bastions, thick but low walls to absorb cannon fire, networks of ditches and trenches, defense in depth, things like that that were not really a part of medieval castle building or were not necessarily relevant for it. All of a sudden, the balance of power shifts back to the defender. And again, it starts to cost more time and more money to besiege a fortified town. And again, time in this sense, as the armies get larger and more expensive to raise and equip, time becomes money, and state structures get bigger and bigger in order to pay for this. War becomes more and more expensive. The scale gets larger. So it's kind of a reciprocal series of processes where technological change drives political change and drives social change. I think that's one way of looking at it. The other way, another way of looking at it would be to say that you're dealing with a society that is increasingly looking at things in monetized contractual terms, and that you start to develop military models that are more in line with a more commercialized society that thinks about labor, including military labor, in monetary contractual terms. So instead of war being an activity that you engage in as a socio-professional, as part of what makes you who you are as a member of a social class, like a knight, or as a temporary occupation, war can be something in a society that every occupation is increasingly professionalized, where everything is increasingly a thing where you are selling your labor, where you may not own the means of production in the way that you did in the Middle Ages. War fits very neatly into these kinds of broader changes in the economy and how people were thinking about labor and work. So I think that all of those factors come together to create a much different military atmosphere in the 16th and 17th centuries.
Now, I'm not a military historian, so I'll have some questions, partly due to my own ignorance. But here's something that interests me about a change in this time, and I don't completely understand it. It seems like in the medieval period that if you could take an important castle or a fort or something very strategically located, that didn't just give you access to this strategic military area, a good hill for lookout or whatever, but a lot of the surrounding territory around it, because it gives you a basis of control. So attached to the single strategic point is a lot of territory. And that's what always seems weird about Byzantine history, where, well, the Sassanids or the Umayyad dynasty made it all the way to the walls of Constantinople. And I think, wait, they practically crossed the entire empire. So what's up with that? But it seems like in the early modern period, it's not like if you get this fort or this castle, you get everything with it, or do you? How does that work? And can you explain that whole process? That always mystified me.
Okay, yeah. So there are a couple of different things to touch on there. And one would be the contrast between Western Europe and the East. So to start with, at all periods following about, I would say, 900, 950, the West was much more heavily fortified in terms of density of fortifications on the ground than the East was, because everybody got to, like, every local lord in the end of the early Middle Ages, beginning of the High Middle Ages, every local lord builds their own castle. Like, there are castles in every district all through France and Germany and Spain and Italy and England. Like, there are castles everywhere. When you get into the early modern period, the density of fortification, again, is incredibly high. Like, every town in Flanders has its modern walls. Every town in Italy has its modern walls, pretty much. The network of fortifications that Vauban builds for the Bourbon kings of France is insanely dense. So basically, it's a matter of density of fortification, that it's not just – you're right. You to control – territory in a heavily fortified land, you need to have you need to be able to control the strongest points there. So it's not enough to control territory. You have to control the castle or the fort that dominates that land. You're absolutely right about that. The problem is there's so many of them. There's so many castles. Like, you know, there's a castle here. There's a castle 10 miles down the road. There's a castle 10 miles down the road. There's another castle 10 miles down the road from that one. Like, when you get into these areas that are incredibly densely fortified, even controlling one incredibly strategic castle doesn't mean that you can control everything. And that, I think, is a major difference between East and West. And it has to do with the devolution of power, of political power, that as royal authority after the Carolingians in Western Europe kind of devolves into the hands of first regional lords and then local lords, everybody wanted their own center of power. And that created a tradition that created a landscape where there were just fortifications all over the place. Not all of them were big. Not all of them were really important. But, like, you could find, like, you know, a simple hilltop fort just about everywhere you were looking.
And if I understand correctly from the Crusades, that's part of why a really puny force of Western knights and other members of this military could hold out for so long against a much larger fighting force and much larger army that is very experienced in warfare, because they simply have more experience building these fortifications, and they can hold out Remer in Jerusalem and these other places for quite a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an underrated piece of the First Crusade in general, is like, these were all people who knew how sieges worked. They knew what you were supposed to do when you besieged someplace, because that was what warfare in the West was for the vast majority of the Middle Ages, was sieges. Like, we tend to think about warfare in terms of pitched battles, and frankly, that's a mistake. We want to find pitched battles because they seem to us to be decisive, to lead directly to a much broader outcome. First of all, that's kind of a misleading way of approaching battles in general. Most battles are not decisive. Mm-hmm. Most battles don't lead to some easily discernible conclusion. But really, most of warfare before Napoleon pretty much was about sieges, because if you could hold a strong point, if you could dominate the surrounding territory, if you could tie up armies, then you could drag out warfare and make decisive outcomes much harder to come by. So when we're talking about the First Crusade, especially, like, these were all people who had spent their formative years besieging castles. Like, that was what they had been doing from the time they were in late childhood and early adulthood, was, okay, my vassal is rebelling against me. He's got a castle. I need to show up with my vassals. Let's dig our trenches. Let's get ready to starve them out. Let's build a catapult or whatever we need to do. And like, they were just used to doing that. That was, you know, the scale of fortifications that they were dealing with when they got to Antioch and Jerusalem was more than they were used to, maybe. But like, that was part of their mental landscape of how warfare was supposed to work. And you're right, when it came time to start controlling this newly conquered territory, it's not a coincidence that they turned to castles, because that was A, the form of territorial control that they knew, and B, it was one that was really well suited to having relatively small numbers of people holding a pretty extensive territory.
Yeah, if anyone wants an example, the conquest of Jerusalem in the First Crusade, it practically reads like the Crusaders built the siege craft in an all-nighter. They like mm-hmm. they throw together these siege towers in a really, really short amount of time and go over the walls. So it's crazy. So I want to ask you about, what's it like to hold down a territory in the early modern period, when now castles don't do what they once did? You can blow them up. The Theodosian city walls, which are probably the most powerful fortress in all of history, that's how they finally get through. They are able to just blow them up with gunpowder. So you can't hold territory that way. And you mentioned there's different fortification designs that are built to be able to withstand this better, but it's still not the same. So how do you hold territory when you're not just relying on long sieges and thick walls?
Okay, so this is the major military development, I would say, of the end of the 15th century and the beginning of the 16th century. And it actually has a lot to do with the Ottomans. Like, the major site of military innovation, or one of them, at the end of the Middle Ages and beginning of the early modern period is the Balkans, because you have what amount to long service Italian mercenaries and Italian military engineers who are trying to figure out how you deal with the seemingly unstoppable tide of a cutting edge Ottoman army rolling through all of this territory. So the first advances in terms of how to deal with a cannon equipped besieging army really take place as a result of trying to figure out how to deal with the Ottomans. And then those innovations get taken back to Italy in the form of these Italian military engineers, and they get put to use building walls for Italian towns basically in the first half of the 16th century. And then the science of military engineering and military fortifications spreads out from there. But it's amazing. Like, you can draw the lines directly from people who were fighting the Ottomans at the end of the 15th century directly to the people who were building these walls at the beginning of the 16th century. And from there, it spread outward to the rest of Europe. But it's amazing how fast this shift happens back from the offensive force of cannon being able to take pretty much any fortified site very quickly back to the defensive. It happens within about 50 years. By the middle of the 16th century, again, the balance of power has swung back to the defenders. And then we're in a situation that, again, looks a lot like most of the Middle Ages, where you've got to, okay, you're going to besiege something. You've got to show up with your army. You've got to dig your trenches. You've got to get ready to starve them out. hopefully blow some breaches in the walls and maybe make an assault. But most battles in the early modern period end up being ones where a relief force is trying to bring aid to a besieged town or fortress. So again, like, warfare really quickly shifts back to the form that it had before in broad strategic outline.
When we think of warfare in the more modern period, the Napoleonic Wars, for example, we imagine these large columns marching in open fields and to engage each other in these open areas. When does warfare shift to that, where it's not about sieges, but it's about engaging each other in open combat?
Okay, so that's a really interesting question. I would say when you get to the American Revolution and when you get into the wars of the French Revolution, and the Napoleonic Wars, things really start to shift. At the end of the 17th century and through most of the 18th century, the armies of these emerging fiscal military states that dominated Europe were pretty small in proportion to the overall population. They were highly professionalized and highly drilled. Like the army of the Prussians is the best example of this. Like Frederick the Great's army, they were pretty small and they were pretty professional, and that meant that soldiers were hard to replace. So really, you wanted to husband your resources as much as possible. You didn't want to throw soldiers away in a potential bloodbath of an open battle. You really didn't so much want to do that. When you get to the French Revolution, the scale of war drastically changes again, right? Because of the levée en masse, the idea that every citizen of the French Republic was a potential soldier, was a soldier that you could draft into service at any given time, mass conscription. All of a sudden, you have armies of hundreds of thousands taking the field. If you go back to the War of the Spanish Succession at the beginning of the 18th century, there were also really big armies at that point. Like at one point, the French had 250,000, 300,000 troops under arms. But the form of warfare was not one of decisive battles. Like the Duke of Marlborough, the famous English general who won victories at like the Battle of Blenheim. He fought like four pitched battles in his career and fought like 40 or some odd sieges or more than that. And there's a letter that he wrote. I can't remember the exact wording of it, but basically he's talking about his military career as a succession of sieges. Pitched battles were risky. And if you had a limited supply of troops with which to fight those pitched battles, and troops were hard to train and hard to replace, then you didn't want to engage in them kind of willy-nilly. You know, you wanted to pick your spots. Sieges were much less risky, if much less exciting and much more grindy and attritional. But when you get to the French Revolution, then all of a sudden you've got hundreds of thousands of troops under arms. You have it's hard to supply them logistically, so you had better get out there and try to fight a decisive battle. And that happened to suit Napoleon's particular skill sets pretty well.
It's interesting to hear that as an American, because we learn about our own military history, and we typically start with the American Revolution, where you have a lot of guerrilla warfare and some pitched battles that are important, some sieges, but not really those that stick in our memory. And we think of sieges in the modern period as anomalies, like the Siege of Stalingrad in World War II. But yeah, it seems like this form of, if we can call it medieval warfare, continues into the early modern period, however much it evolves due to different fortification technologies and defensive gunfire as well as offensive gunfire. So do you see some lines of continuity between the medieval and early modern period also?
Yeah, and I think in general, like, we have to kind of, as useful as period designators like medieval and early modern are, we need to recognize their limitations. It's not like people went to bed one night as medieval and woke up one morning as early modern, you know? That to some extent these designators are artificial, and what you choose to designate as medieval or early modern is not self-evident. It's an argument. It's an argument about what matters and at what point. And so there's no clear dividing line between medieval and early modern warfare. There's long series of evolutionary processes and steps backward and steps forward and sidesteps that don't go anywhere. Like the Hussites in Bohemia. There was a kind of a religious revolt in Bohemia in around the 1410s, 1420s, and they did a lot of really interesting things militarily. Like it was a kind of an extremist sect, But they did a lot of interesting things. Like they used a lot of gunpowder. They used a lot. They had like mobile defensive fortifications based around wagons. It was, and they beat off a whole bunch of like pretty cutting edge late medieval armies with what seems to be pretty innovative and what could have been revolutionary things. But it doesn't go anywhere. Like it's just this one little thing that happens to be really influential and really successful for a brief period of time, and then everybody kind of forgets about it. And there are a lot of these advances and retreats in terms of the overall landscape of innovation. It's not like a straightforward story of progress, of everything reaching toward a point that more closely resembles modern warfare. And you could say that about this distinct period from say 1500 to 1700 anyway, is that this is the great age of privatized warfare, that standing armies under the direct control of the state are an anomaly rather than the norm, that mostly because there's no nationalism, there's no nation state as we understand it. Like it didn't matter, the army of the Swedish King Gustavus Adolphus in the 30 Years' War is only a little bit Swedish. Like the core of it is Swedish, but then he's got German mercenaries and Scottish mercenaries and Irish mercenaries and mercenaries from Bohemia and mercenaries from Hungary, all fighting in the army of the Swedish king. So warfare is privatized, it's handled through private contractors. It's mercenary warfare in the sense that soldiers could and did come from just about anywhere. It's not the direct forerunner in a lot of ways of the kind of warfare that we understand. Like there are ways in which it leads toward that, but there are also ways in which it's its own distinct thing. So, and in that sense, in the kind of mercenary, privatized, contract-based sense, it's the direct descendant of late medieval warfare and not necessarily the direct ancestor of warfare as we understand it.
That's a good point about periodization. It's useful for us in a way to conceptualize these changes over time, but it's not like a serf wakes up and says, hey, it's 1500 AD. I'm emancipated. I'm going to go throw off my garb and get some poofy trousers and a codpiece and walk around with my doubloons in the Renaissance. So,
yeah. And if you're a serf, if you're a peasant in Eastern Europe, you are much more likely to be a serf in 1550 than you were in 1500.
Yeah, definitely. So it's a trajectory upward, but there's a lot of it's a jagged line, let us say. So I want to try a thought experiment on these changes that are happening. And you described earlier how this process has a lot of factors, and you started with technology, but then there's also bureaucratization that's happening, how politics comes into this, and it's a complicated process. But let's say you get sent back in time to 1300, and you want to kick off the early modern period. You want to rule Europe and think, okay, I'm going to begin this chain reaction. I need a catalyst to get things going. And this is a whole genre of science fiction. There's a really campy book called Lest Darkness Fall that was written in the 1930s about this modern guy who gets sent back to 500 and basically single-handedly invents gunpowder, movable type, brandy, telegraphs in a space of about a year. So it's super campy and cheesy, but a really funny read. So what would you do? You think, would you be a metallurgist and craft some small firearms? Would you start off your own bureaucracy and invent double bookkeeping? Or what would you do to kick off the early modern period?
So I would say, in general, I don't think that any one individual is in a position to do all that much. Like I don't think that I think that aggregate actions are really what drive history much more so than the actions of people at the very top, no matter how influential. I think there are some exceptions, some very obvious exceptions, but for the most part, I tend to think of history more as an upswelling of a lot of people doing collective things. But in the sense of the thought experiment here, I think that the biggest things are the invention or bureaucracy. I think the spread of contracts, explicit contracts as an institution, where you have mechanisms for the enforcement of agreements between people, formal agreements between people, and the kind of spread of contracts and contractual language and contractual ideas throughout society. I think that's a big one. And the connection of that to money, not just to money as a medium of exchange, but in terms of thinking monetarily. I think that's the, I think those are the kinds of things that I think really define the early modern period as opposed to the earlier Middle Ages. So if I were going to kick it off, it would be some combination of bureaucratic organization, explicit contracts backed up by thinking in monetary terms and not just using money. I think those are really the biggest things that you could point to.
Right. And that's very accurate, as unsexy as it sounds, where you basically have to be a patent attorney running around your little fief and forcing people to sign things. But
making sure that you collect things and writing everything down in neat little double entry bookkeeping this is my favorite thing about double entry bookkeeping. And like these Italian merchants, is they would put little inscriptions on there that said "for God and profit," we tend to think about those two things as kind of separate, but like, no, that was, you know, it was for both. It was both for God and for profit is what we're going to put in our account books.
Yep. So it's the IRS that created the modern world, as really boring as it sounds, but there we are.
In a lot of really meaningful ways. Yeah, that's true. Like bureaucratic organization and taxation are at the heart, because like, if you get taxes imposed on you, right? If somebody says you need to pay me this at this particular amount of time, well, you need to have something to pay them with. That tends to drive people toward wage earning, because that's what's going to give you cash. It drives people towards more market-based, more monetized economic arrangements in order to be able to pay for that. So like, that's as strange as it sounds, like just asking for taxes has a ripple effect that spreads throughout the rest of the economy. And from the rest of the economy throughout society as a whole.
This is maybe why people don't buy history books anymore. But yeah, I mean, it's bureaucratization that lifts this up. It's not, I don't know, in the 1800s, you had these great men of history biographies where Napoleon single-handedly introduces movable type to the Arabs, and Napoleon single-handedly brings modernization to these areas. But movable type, it's not really about having a modern mind. It's like you said, we need tax records so we can pay for larger armies, because us, the Ottomans, are really getting defeated by these other people. So we need more funds to revolutionize things.
Movable type is a fascinating example, because the technology had existed elsewhere for a long period of time. Part of the reason why it becomes such a big deal in Europe, why printing explodes, is because there are highly commercialized economies in urban areas that are ready to turn printing into a profit-making industry. Like the social and cultural context exists to take that technological advance and turn it into a thing that has much, much wider ramifications for it. Like within like 15 years, there's a whole printing industry in Venice. You know, like there are commercial centers that are there and available that can conceptualize things in terms of market demand and take a technological innovation and put it to use to meet that market demand. Like there are all of these preconditions that already existed to make use of these things. And gunpowder, I think, is the same way, that like you had kind of nascent bureaucratic structures that already existed. And they were like, oh, well, we need to pay for cannon. Well, we have these structures in place. OK, let's make more use of these structures.
Right. And accelerate them onward. And that's something that I like that you've done with your podcast, where you look at these meta issues that are going across centuries, but then you also get on the ground and look at the stories of people who are living through them and what that's like. And one story that of a soldier that I think exemplifies these changes, and I'm really going to mispronounce this, so bear with me, Götz von Berlichingen. How do I say that?
Götz von Berlichingen. So Götz von Berlichingen, he was born in about 1480. He was a German. He was a German knight, kind of a lower end of a noble family. And Götz kind of exemplifies both the going backwards and the going forwards aspects of this early modern period and the transition from medieval to early modern, because he's a knight. And he thinks of his profession as warfare because that's how he was raised. He was raised to be a warrior, more or less. But his warrior activities take place in a really rapidly changing military and social and economic context. So he is a professional soldier, but that's taking place in a context of contract armies rather than like fighting for honor. And you know, he's going out and fighting feuds but which can run the gamut from full-scale wars all the way down to, I don't like the way that guy looked at me, I'm going to assemble a bunch of guys and go beat him up. So he's subject to like kind of the increasing power of sovereign states, but he's also still carrying out violence on his own behalf, like private violence. He's a robber knight, but he's also part and parcel of this like military revolution. He's a kind of an interesting transitional figure. He's also interesting because he got his hand shot off by a cannonball. And so he had an iron prosthetic. Like, he's known as Gertz of the Iron Hand because he has like an iron prosthetic hand that apparently didn't stop him from continuing to kill peasants whenever he could.
Wow. Like,
he's just a wildly interesting figure. He wrote a great autobiography that's basically a litany of all of his feuds and wars and people he didn't like and people that he killed and people that he stole money from and people who insulted him and slighted him and how he got back at them and great battles that he fought in. And like, he's just like a wildly interesting figure, but it's a reminder that there's no firm dividing line between these two things. Like, Gertz, he dies in 1562. He's both a medieval and a modern figure. Like, there are ways that you look at his life that are incredibly modern. And there are ways that you look at his life because he lived through the Reformation. Like, he was part and parcel of all these big developments. But at the same time, he's also a thoroughly medieval figure in terms of his mental landscape and the way that he's thinking about his rights and his jurisdictions and his like ability to fight on his own behalf. Like, that's a thoroughly medieval idea, you know?
Well, I'd like you to explain what I think is a really important concept, the monopoly of violence that a state has. Could you think of a couple stories, maybe a story from someone in the medieval period that exemplifies how the state does not have a monopoly on violence? And if you want to, you can take matters into your own hands. And then can you think of a story in the early modern period that shows how warfare takes place through this growing monopoly of violence of the state?
Okay. So, yeah, so this is in kind of classical political theory. This is, and this goes back to Max Weber writing in the earlier 20th century. One of the ideas here is that the state, as it grows, as it rises, as it becomes a thing, carries out, gets to or has as a goal the monopolization of violence and power within its borders, that it is a territorially defined concept. And within that territory, the state is the one that gets to use violence and nobody else does. In the Middle Ages, that was never an assumption. Right. And, you know, like whenever you're dealing with an ideal type like Weber's, there's always going to be a lot of room for elsewhere, because you get to things like lynchings in 20th century America, which is undeniably a territorial sovereign state. Like, that's still extra state violence that exists and was in some sense a sanction. So there are always going to be exceptions to the idea of a state monopoly of violence. But by and large, it's more of a spectrum than anything else. But I digress. To take it back to the Middle Ages, let's say you are the Count of Toulouse in kind of southwestern France, and one of your vassals decides that he's not going to do what you told him to do. He's going to do something that you don't like. If you're the Count of Toulouse, you don't appeal to the King of France and say, "Well, we need to do something about this." You say, "No, I'm going to handle that myself." So you get your other vassals and you go and you're going to go put down your rebellious vassal. Or let's say you're that rebellious vassal and you've got a rebellious vassal underneath you, somebody who controls like a town or like a small castle, and they're not doing something that you told them to do. You're their superior. You don't appeal to your superior to handle that. You handle that yourself. For medieval lords, the ability and willingness to carry out violence on your own behalf was what made you a lord. That you didn't have to appeal to somebody else. Within your territories, you were the final arbiter of that. And part of the story of how the medieval becomes the modern is the way in which those lords lost the rights to do that. And it takes longer in some places than others. Eventually, pretty much everybody ends up ceding that power to an overarching state structure. That's kind of what makes the Holy Roman Empire hard for us to wrap our heads around, is because that doesn't really happen there. It doesn't fit neatly into this story of the rising power of the state. But so let's say, 13th century, you're a lord and your vassal does something you don't want them to do, you can go do something about that yourself. You don't need to appeal to anybody else. Now, let's say it's the 17th century and there's some sort of rebellion somewhere. Then it's going to be the state that handles that and not necessarily a private lord who takes it upon himself to do that. Like there's a fundamental difference in the later you go in terms of who's going to be handling putting down something like a rebellion.
Okay. And I think that explanation also can help people understand why you were probably 10 to 20 times more likely to die a violent death in the Middle Ages versus today.
Mm-hmm.
When there's just so much fighting and so many different claims of sovereignty going around.
There was just more friction. There was more friction between different people who were claiming different jurisdictions and rights. Like the way to understand the Middle Ages is to understand that people thought about the world in terms of their claims to rights. Like you didn't really own land. Because land was not something that you thought of as property per se, or as a kind of a movable property for which there was a market to sell it. You thought about land as something that existed in perpetuity to which you had rights. And you thought about territory as something to which you had rights. You thought about the use of a mill as something to which you had rights. And so in a landscape where everybody thinks they have rights to things, that creates a lot of opportunities for friction. And a lot of the story of how the medieval becomes the modern is the story of how those various claims to rights get quashed. That instead of having a right to use this land and a right to use this mill and a right to control this particular territory and a right to take the taxes from this thing, it's the sovereign state kind of slowly but surely taking over rights to a whole bunch of different things from kind of lesser intermediaries. It's a story of a simplification of rights. And on the one hand, the other way to look at it would be a loss of rights. That would be the flip side to that story.
Such as the ideas underpinning the Constitution of life, liberty, and property. Most students get the first part, life, liberty. They think, okay, that's similar to the pursuit of happiness. But when they hear property, think, wait, that sounds tacked on. That sounds like a boring thing that I hear at city council meetings. Property, though, is very, very important when it can be one of the fundamental linchpins of all this warfare happening. And yeah, individual rights.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can't. I would say that if you want to understand the United States, the life and liberty parts are way less important than the property part. Like that the vast majority of political conflict in the United States over the past 200 and some odd years has really been about property and is still about property today. Everything from debates about slavery to the Tea Party uprisings in 2009, and 2010 are really fundamentally about property, who has rights to it and who gets to use it. Is your right to your property inalienable? What involvement does government have in separating you from your property or taking a percentage of your property? Like those really most conflicts in the United States have fundamentally been about that much more so than more amorphous concepts of life and liberty.
So Patrick, to tie in a lot of these things together, for you as a medievalist and for, as you said, the past is a foreign country, and I totally agree with that because I don't want to project our values onto the past. Some authors have also talked about the past as a laboratory of human experience, where throughout history, different societies have dealt with universal issues that we today deal with. And some historians of the Ottoman Empire have noted perhaps a positive things about an empire, that for all its faults, it offers things that we don't really have in the nation state, where people with different identities can express themselves maybe with more freedom than the nation state that tries to homogenize everything. So for you as a medievalist, are there any things that you can think of that are positive that maybe we in the modern world could stand to learn from that would make our lives better if we understood in a more fuller way?
Yeah. So I think there are really two things. And these are things that I've been thinking about a lot lately. I'm working on episodes on the late medieval and early modern economy and the rise of capitalism. The first one I would say is the idea of communal organization and experience. That medieval people, the idea that the individual didn't exist in the Middle Ages is overblown. But people did define themselves much more strongly in terms of what communities they belonged to. They thought of themselves as parts of corporate wholes much more so than as atomized individuals. Like, we live in an age of atomized individuals. And I think that it would behoove us to remember that that was not always the case, and that you can find membership and meaning by belonging to a broader group, and that that's not necessarily a bad thing. That, like, belonging to a broader group does not mean that you subsume your what makes you an individual. It's a way of kind of finding meaning and defining ourselves in the place of the world. Medieval people were, and early modern people too, were really big on this. And there are a lot of forms of corporate membership. It was things like guild membership, memberships in confraternities and brotherhoods. There were lots and lots of forms of communal organization in the medieval and early modern worlds that we have kind of lost out on, like especially over the last 30, 40 years or so in this country, especially. I think remembering that there are groups out there, that you can be a part of a group and that you can derive meaning in about yourself and your place in the world, I think that's a big one. The other, I think, is the idea of moral economy, that there were medieval people thought really long and hard about the about how commercial activity and trade and the pursuit of money affected society as a whole, for better and for worse. And they thought long and hard about ways to make sure that that served positive purposes, which is in our day and age is a discussion that we've kind of lost. We have kind of forgotten about the we live in the post 80s post Gordon Gekko world of greed is good, and frankly it's worth remembering that there should be a discourse about that, like, the unrelenting pursuit of profit is not a given that is somehow good for everybody, and that we should think long and hard about the ways in which that pursuit reverberates through society more broadly and what our obligations are to other people. That was something that medieval people and early modern people thought about a lot, is what is my relationship to this other person? What do we owe each other? What rights do we have? What obligations do we have? And what does commercial activity mean for all of us as a whole? Those are things that they thought about a lot. They spent a lot of time chewing them over and trying to think about how commercial activity and the pursuit of money benefited or didn't benefit society. And I think those are things that we could stand to think about more often.
Plenty to learn from in the past. And speaking of learning from things in the past, you have a podcast where you delve into all of these issues much more deeply. So Patrick, if people want to learn more about what you do online and find you, where can they go?
So my podcast Tides of History is available anywhere you look for anywhere you look for your podcasts: Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, whatever. Anywhere you look for a podcast, you'll find Tides of History. I do 3 episodes a month. I do generally 2 substantive episodes and 1 interview. I've got an interview coming out with Dan Jones, the author of a brand new book on the Templars, which is amazing. I've got that coming out. I'll have 2 episodes on Roman cities and their decline and fall coming out in October. And then in November, I'll have 2 episodes on the rise of capitalism. So I got a lot of interesting topics coming up on that. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at Patrick Wyman MMA.
Great. And I'll link to those in the show notes. Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
So again, that was the interview with Patrick Wyman. If you want to get all those resources, you can go to historyunplugpodcast.com and find them all there. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site, historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.